I think by now we're all fully aware, at least I hope so, the deplorable state of Canada's armed forces. The equipment that we have is it's old. It's not working properly. The entire procurement process is just a bloody mess. Takes forever to get replacement equipment. And to add insult to injury, there was an infamous issue of Canadian Military Journal. This is the official publication of the Canadian Armed Forces that just basically, it's like kicking a dying patient when they were down. And we're going to get into that right now with John Robson. He's the executive director of the Climate Discussion Nexus. He's a documentary filmmaker, historian, author, columnist with the National Post, the Epoch Times, and the Western Standard. And he joins us now. John, welcome back. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Very well. You mentioned in your article that, you know, your column, the timing is kind of interesting here. When the state of the military and all of their recruitment issues and so forth, it's the morale has never been worse. The state of the equipment has never been worse. Then they choose at that precise moment to release this infamous issue, you call it, of the Canadian Military Journal. Just maybe for those not familiar with what that collection of essays was all about, just kind of give us a summation.
It reads exactly as you would expect it to read if you were told that for some reason the Canadian Forces brass had gone full metal woke at this exact moment. It's full of language about patriarchy, colonialism, white supremacy, heteronormativity, ableism and classism. And that, by the way, is a quotation, not me just reading the stuff off from one of them. And then it talks about an anti-oppression framework that builds on a set of critical theories, including feminist, decolonial, critical race, queer, critical disability, and critical political economy theories. And if you imagine yourself in a room with people thinking, we need to do something for the Canadian Forces. They're in terrible conditions. It's a recruiting crisis. The equipment's no good. Basically, the heads of the services are now coming out and saying we're incapable. And you might think – and imagine that you actually want to decolonize it and feminize it and all these kind of things. You might nevertheless say to yourselves, perhaps this is not a good moment. We've really got to recruit some more people. The pay is lousy. The work is frustrating. They know they can't do anything. Let's hold off on this just for now. But that's not the way these people think. And one of the things you listed in my biography, I am a historian by training. And one of the lessons that I draw from history is that people believe their beliefs and that the people running this country actually think that only a decolonized, non-patriarchal, feminist, anti-ableist armed forces can really fight effectively. They literally believe that we would get more combat effectiveness out of social justice warriors than the kind who fought in two world wars. And so they think at this critical moment to strengthen the forces, what we really have to do is push through DEI totally. We've got to get rid of all these white men we've been recruiting from rural Canada with their church going and their intact families, because these are the kind of people that create a toxic environment in which no organization can function. They really think this, and therefore they thought this is just the moment.
Right, and they chose to do this just as we're on the cusp, possibly, of World War III. Great timing.
Yes, again, to look at the world as it is today and think what we need now is not urgent fixes for combat readiness, but a thorough cultural transformation of a sort that may take decades. Of course, if these people thought in terms of conventional military force and so forth, then they'd have been investing in the military years ago. As Tristan Hopper pointed out in today's National Post, you've got a situation where virtually every part of government is growing, but they're cutting $1 billion out of the military. So in one sense, obviously, their point is not to field combat-ready units. It is to become so wonderfully progressive that nobody could hate us except our traditional allies. And, you know, it's funny. Years and years ago, I wrote a column about the Canadian military and the wrong course it was taking. And I got an email from a guy who'd been involved in D-Day. He's now passed on, of course. And in the course of my conversations with him, at one point, he showed me, he was the intelligence officer for the Glens, how did you lay out the regiment for in kind of defensive situation? You've reached your position, you're not about to attack, and so here's where Company A, Company B, Company C, D's in reserve, here's where you put the barbed wire, here are the minefields, here are the prearranged artillery strikes. All this kind of stuff is of no interest to people like Justin Trudeau. And I think our defense minister, if you were to ask them about this, they would have no clue what you were talking about. They don't think about the military in those terms.
When did this rot begin?
In some sense, I'm sorry to say, it goes back practically to the founding of the country. If you look at our preparedness before World War I, we had two obsolete cruisers firing black powder shells. Before World War II, we had six tanks, and each of them was a death trap. We literally had soldiers on maneuver shouting, bang. But back then, it was just parsimony. It wasn't this extraordinary notion that the conventional virtues that we once thought made Canada what it is were actually what made Canada not worth defending. And I would say that this probably started seeping in about 20 odd years ago when I wrote that column. But of course, everything's gotten much worse under Justin Trudeau. Every party neglects the military. It's not a vote buyer. But Trudeau has this really aggressive left-wing agenda, even more than his father, who certainly was no bargain when it came to the military. So it has swept through our institutions, and it has come to the point where everything that it touches is ruined. I mean, these bureaucrats sitting around thinking what the military needs is DEI. How's your department working with all this going on? And of course, morale in the federal public service is terrible, even though something like one in four of them makes a six-figure salary. They have this amazing job security. They've got fully funded, defined benefit pensions. I mean, they're living high off the hog. But people in the public service aren't happy because the whole thing is not working. Nothing is working. They can't do a digital passport. They can't combat smuggling. They can't build housing. They can't really do anything. It's the most amazing, you know, powerful, wealthy, unconstrained by law, helpless organism that you could ever imagine.
All right, John, we will take a quick time out. When we come back, we'll get to more of our conversation. The intellectual assault on Canada's military. That's Trudeau calling now. He's not happy. So be it. All right, back with more in a moment. Don't go away. And we are back with John Robson, historian, columnist, documentary filmmaker, executive director of the Climate Discussion Nexus. And we're talking about his latest piece, The Intellectual Assault on Canada's Military. Just kind of frame the state of the recruitment crisis that we're undergoing right now.
The situation in the Canadian military is so bad that even if you're used to it, it's a little bit hard to believe that it's happening the way that it really is. I mean, I think most people know that we're spending about 1.38% of our GDP. And I've seen different numbers on how much that is total, but it's somewhere under $27 billion. They don't even list it separately in the budget anymore. That's how little they care. But we're also in a situation where the head of the Navy, Angus Topshe, put out a video in November saying the Navy is in a critical state. Normally, the Canadian brass pretend everything's fine. I mean, I understand sort of loyalty, stiff upper lip, take one for the team, make do with what you've got. But they finally just had it with that. Only about 43% of the Air Force is meeting its training and readiness requirements. This is it's absolute catastrophe. We don't show up for NATO exercises anymore because we can't spare any aircraft. And we are short, I'm trying to remember what the exact number is, but we are short tens of thousands of people, and we're bleeding specialists because it's not a well-paid career. There's a lot of disruption to family life, and you don't have the satisfaction you once had of knowing that you were making a difference in some incredible way. So all the things, and the notion, again, that people join the military because they want to defend the nice people from the bad people. This is very hard for those in power to understand again, because this is not how they think about the world. They don't understand what motivates people. They think resentment is the thing that motivates most people. But the Canadian military has not been staffed by people who are overcome with resentment. And so we are simply not attracting people at all, and we're not retaining the people we do attract. And again, you look at, I mean, I remember going on one of Canada's frigates when they were new, and back then I was new too. That was a long time ago. Our submarines are not seaworthy. Our aircraft are not flight worthy. Our tanks are not battle worthy to the extent that we even have any. And Ukraine was begging us for ammunition. And we were looking at our ammunition and thinking, no, I think we have to scrap it instead. It's just so old, you can't use it. And the Ukrainians are like, hey, give us it. You know, we'll try it. And we're like, oh, no, you know, we have to fill out the form. But the fact is that we have artillery shells that we wouldn't dare fire. And if you look, the Ukraine war, one of the surprises, it's been a lot more like World War One than anybody expected. The critical weapon on the battlefield is artillery, tens and tens of thousands of shells. It has been a high-intensity artillery war, and we are so unready for such a thing, and we're not ramping up production. It takes us 15 years to buy an asset. We start buying a ship, and both world wars could go by back-to-back before we even get it.
How did we ever manage to survive World War II? If you say this began, the rot began the founding of the country. How did we, what is the lesson learned? What did we do right in World War II? I mean, we became this an amazing fighting force.
Well, we did a couple of things right. One was being a long way from trouble, so we had time to rebuild. But even that, I mean, had Britain gone under in 1940, we would not have had time, though the U.S. would probably have protected us. But back then, we had an energetic populace that was patriotic, that believed in country, that believed in God. And I'm going to say we had intact families, too. We had a very different kind of people who could put their shoulder to the wheel and get it done. And we finished the war. The statistics vary, but by the time the bad guys are vanquished, third largest navy in the world, maybe fourth. Same thing with our Air Force. We did a lot of production. You know, of course, the Americans helped on that too. But we were a people who could really do things. But remember, we had a couple of years. And I remember the story of George Blackburn. He was with the 1st Canadian Division deployed to Britain. At the time, they thought there might be a paratroop attack. And one night, there was an alarm that turned out to be false. They all went and deployed. When they came back to their barracks and went to clean their weapons, they discovered that their rifles still had the jelly from the factory. Not one of them could have fired a shot. And that's really not a great way. And in the modern world, things move faster. And if you think the clowns in charge of this country are ready for a cyber attack from people in the People's Liberation Army in China or from Russia's cyber experts or even the Iranians, not a hope. They have no idea what this is about. These people probably couldn't clear the cache on their browser. They don't even understand the threat, let alone try to address it. And yet, anytime you ask, oh, we'll continue this and blah, 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 this soothing rhetoric that ought to burn their tongues, it's so shameful. But instead, it just comes pouring out and smothers you.
Is it too far gone?
No, I always say optimism is a psychological condition and fatuous, but hope is a theological virtue. We can change it, but we need to start now, and we need to start by not accepting lies and evasions. Anytime the prime minister or one of his colleagues says continue, you know they've been caught not doing something they wouldn't know how to do if they tried. We must insist that we will give up some of our lavish social benefits to put money back into the military. And even Pierre Poilievre is like, well, yeah, maybe I'll do this and that, but he's done the polling math and stuff, and he knows it's not a big vote winner, and he's not going to lead on principle. It's up to us to say, rebuild the military, double defense spending. You got to go from 26 to 52. You can't run bigger deficits. Cut some of the other stuff. There's a whole bunch of reforms, but it needs to get back to the thing that Canadians are resilient people. I remember somebody once saying years ago, we were up at a cottage looking out at the landscape, and he said, this is the real Canada. These are people who could fix their snowmobile with their chainsaw. And that's who we need to see ourselves as if we're going to turn this around.
I'm just very quickly, does this perception or this treatment of our armed forces explain the way that we treat our veterans or the federal government treats our veterans? I mean, they're living in deplorable conditions. They're out on the street. They're killing themselves. They're offered suicide as an option when they call the vet hotline. Is it kind of a continuum? Is this part of the same attitude?
I think it is. And I think the veterans make them feel guilty because they know they're behaving badly on this file. And then they actually kind of get angry at the veterans because these are the people who really have first call on us, so I suppose combat readiness, but really have a very strong call on our loyalty. And they treat them so shabbily. It's indicative of the fact that in their hearts, they despise security and they despise warriors. When I read the accounts of what Canadians did in the World Wars, I choke up. And I'll tell you what, these politicians do not. They don't read the accounts. And if they did, they wouldn't find them moving.
The Intellectual Assault on Canada's Military. You can find that at westernstandard.news. It's also in at aristotlefoundation.org. John Robson, historian, author, documentary filmmaker. Thank you so much. Good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure.